Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are a go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we are speaking to TV Ted, Mr. Ted Yacucci. Hello, Ted.
Hi, Len. How are you?
Very good. It's a pleasure to speak to you again. You've been researching and working in media for years. I met you years ago when you were starting some documentaries that you've done, and now I guess you've retired and you have more time to dedicate to this. And on YouTube, you have your own channel, and you have been pumping out some really good content. Last week, you had another video come out. New documents proved the CIA involvement in the JFK assassination. Geez, that's only, I guess, a week ago. And yeah, you've got a lot of subscribers and a lot of views. And hats off. I mean, a lot of people are doing some work, and some I agree with, I don't agree with. But I'm always very interested in anything you're doing. So thank you, first of all, for your good work. And can you just give us a brief overview of your channel, and then maybe just the last episode, and then we're going to get onto some other things.
Sure. Like a lot of people, I was old enough to be about 8 years old when JFK was assassinated, and have been kind of just fascinated with it since the day that I watched Jack Ruby shoot Oswald in the basement of the Dallas City Jail, like a lot of people who were alive at that period. Went into journalism, so I've had an opportunity to be in media pretty much all my life until I retired at the end of last December. Started some serious JFK research about 20 years ago. Have been really, really fortunate to meet some really, really good, interesting people. Yourself at the top of that list, along with, well, Jim DiEugenio and Lisa Pease. I actually had a chance to interview you and Lisa and Jim a few years back. And my research really initially focused on two main areas of the assassination. One was Ruth Payne back in 2013. I almost got her to give me a actual sit down, really in-depth interview. I actually had phone conversations with her over the course of about 3 months and a lot of email correspondence. But I realized that she was trying to qualify me as someone that she could control in the interview. It came down to a litmus test with her of whether I would believe that Lee Oswald was involved with the General Walker shooting. When I was honest and said that there was no evidence that that was the case, and of course that meant that I felt she was lying about her finding the letter that she claimed that Lee Oswald wrote taking blame for that almost assassination, then she wouldn't give me that final interview. But anyway, that was what really got me seriously involved in the JFK assassination. The other aspect of it that I was always intrigued with was the Chicago plot. Went to Chicago several times to do research there, filed several FOIA requests that they answered, but never really got serious answers with them as I expected, but got pretty deep into the research in Chicago and have always been very interested in that aspect of the case. Since I've had time over the last couple of years, and especially since I retired to do some work with the mini documentaries on YouTube, I've really, really enjoyed it. And now that I'm Now that I am retired, I have a lot more time to put forth towards that. I'm really finding that I'm enjoying it even more. The video that I put on a couple of days ago, I had a lot of fun with. I called it, "You May Be a Lone Nutter If," and then I listed about 25 or 30 things about the assassination case that were pretty hard to believe, but I kind of did it in a you may be a lone nutter if. So that's kind of where I am up to this point.
Right. Well, the one that caught my attention was very well delivered and articulate. The new documents prove CIA involvement. And these new documents, you go through the different stages of CIA removing governments, the CIA real dirty tricks, the CIA operating against the American people and against Congress and hiding anything they did. And as you go through, and I urge people to watch that, we'll make a link to that. But why don't you just cover just in a minute or two the overview of that?
Sure.
Because you make it obvious to say, listen, if you have to ignore all this to turn your head away and say, no, the CIA had nothing to do with this.
Well, that's exactly right. And I do try to give some relatively straightforward chronological examples of what the CIA was doing at that period, and especially just how out of control they were. People have, unless you really do just a little bit of research or read a book or two, and it's natural that people wouldn't have any idea what the CIA was actually, how out of control and what they were actually into. What the very first, and I didn't know this before the new docs came out, one of the first things that, a smaller example, but it's what they were doing in British Guyana. And in the minutes of April 25th, 1963, there was a special group meeting. What came out was that the CIA was running, they were running contributions to the presidential candidate, the presidential election in British Guyana. They were running it through the AFL-CIO and George Meany, who was the president of the union at that period. They were running $435,000, not to the presidential election in British Guyana. I misspoke. They were running the money to a strike under the cover of the AFL-CIO contributions. And a CIA cover representative ran that strike program. And I found that it was, to me, it's just absolutely incredible that an American union would be running money through their funding to support a strike in another country, which, of course, was to influence the presidential race, the presidential elections eventually in that country. So that's just British Guyana, which I didn't know about, and I just found that absolutely incredible. And then it goes on in Chile, which had so much violence. Well, back in 1964, the CIA was providing the Christian Democrat candidate, a guy named Eduardo Frei, I think I'm pronouncing that right. Well, they gave him $750,000 in March of 1964. They gave him another $1.25 million in May of 1964 to finance his campaign for the presidency. He was running against Salvador Allende. Also, there was another really, really great example of the CIA actually trying to control another country's, not only their political abilities to have open and honest elections, but also the ability to control where the finances from the resources of that country are coming from. In Chile, there was a gentleman, a guy named Salvador Allende, which a lot of people have heard of. He was trying to become president in 1964, and he was running on a platform of trying to have a much more open and honest and free government, where a lot of poor peasants in Chile would have a chance to really be able to participate and gain a little bit from the industry and the hard work that they were doing to develop the industry in the country of Chile. Well, the CIA didn't really like that the funding and the profits from Chile's industries wouldn't be running through their United States and other government industrial giants. And so what they did was they put in a total of over about $2.5 million in the presidential election of 1964 in order to make sure Allende did not become president. Now, they actually kept that up for the next 8 years or so until 1972, in which even the CIA couldn't stop the people from voting for Allende, and he did become president. Well, what did the CIA do? They sponsored a coup right away in order to overthrow Allende and install a guy named Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet, who was such a dictator, a military dictator, that he actually canceled open, free, democratic elections after that. And the people of Chile were stuck not only with Pinochet for the next 20 years or so, but there was such chaos and such the people were so unhappy that there was upwards of 10,000 people or more who are reported to have lost their lives because of the decision that the CIA made in that case. So that's just another example there of the CIA controlling another company's political infrastructure, and also for the reason of profit. It all comes down to greed and profit. We moved to, this was before Kennedy, but in 1953 and 54, we start with what was happening in Iran, which most people know about it, the overthrow of the democratically elected government in Iran to install the Shah, the gentleman that was called the Shah of Iran. And we know what happened there. He ran the country again like a military dictatorship. Oil profits flowed to Great Britain and the United States. And, you know, that country hasn't been the same ever since. After that, we have confirmation from the new docs of what happened in Guatemala, with President Jacobo Arbenz Guzman being overthrown mainly by the Dulles brothers because of United Fruit Company, of which they were both major stockholders and were on the board of directors and really represented all of the wealthy industrialists that were making money from the United Fruit Company, which actually owned about 84% of the arable land in the country of Guatemala. That's almost unbelievable. So more than 80% of the land was really being controlled by the United Fruit Company, which was really dependent on the CIA. So they overthrew Guzman, and then you have literally hundreds of thousands of people that lost their lives in the chaos of the dictatorships that were put in again for the next 20 years after that. Right away with the success there, actually it was the year before, they had overthrown Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and same old story. They had all of the mines that were in the Congo. It was actually Belgium in this case that was really the prime recipient of the profits that were being extracted from the Congo along with the United States. But what happened? Patrice Lumumba was a gentleman that really promised to try to have a much fairer democracy, a democracy in which a lot of the poor folks in the Congo would be able to benefit. John Kennedy was just being inaugurated in 1960, and well, actually in January of 1961. Everybody knew that he didn't want Lumumba touched. He was a big supporter of Patrice Lumumba. What happened? Dulles and the CIA wanted Lumumba out, and they needed to do it before Kennedy actually was inaugurated, became president. So just a few days before that happened, they had Patrice Lumumba kidnapped and murdered. Kennedy was distraught. John Kennedy was absolutely distraught when he found out that that happened. And there's a famous picture of him on the phone receiving the news of the death of Patrice Lumumba. It gets even worse after that. The president of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, I'm probably saying his name wrong, but he was in Africa to do the research of why, to find out exactly why Patrice Lumumba was kidnapped and murdered. And his plane blew up in Africa. It exploded in the air. So almost assuredly, there was a bomb on board. And almost everyone associates that bombing with the CIA. And it goes to show at that point, if they're willing to assassinate the president of the head of the United Nations and the head of other countries, democratically elected countries, that means that they are so out of control. They are running their, I don't really like the whole shadow government expression, but that's exactly what they were, a shadow government, at least from 1954 through 1970 under Dulles up until, 1960 or 61 when Kennedy fired him, although he really stayed in a lot of control. So you have all of these things. Not only that, but in the charter, I don't know, in the 1947 CIA charter, where it said that the CIA could have a mind control program like MK Ultra, which they were running without a participant's knowledge, working on mind control. They actually had, a lot of people know this. They actually had programs where they were using LSD a lot in mind control experiments. There's some famous examples where they gave participants LSD for 77 straight days. There's deaths that were attributed to MKUltra, probably many more than we know about. And what did Richard Helms do, who was the head of the CIA? He illegally destroyed not all, but most of the files about MKUltra when he was ordered to testify about the program in front of Congress. Along with that, we have Operation Mockingbird, which was I don't know that people really understand. People think about terms of, fake news and that whole concept. Now, well, the CIA perfected that with Operation Mockingbird, and they did that by beginning to insert agents into major news media in the United States and around the world. But they just kept increasing and increasing that program until they actually had, and this is documented, they had 3,000 associates on the payroll of the CIA. They were in every major newspaper. They were in every major television network at that point. And it's just amazing. So whenever they wanted a story to be put out, they were able to put it out. When they wanted to stop a story, they were able to do that because they could just have one of their agents write a story which discredited whatever they wanted discredited. And it's frightening. It's so frightening to think that, that we citizens of the United States really haven't been getting open and honest news for at least since the 1950s. And, when we think about the Zapruder film, which is, a good example in the JFK assassination case, Henry Luce of Time magazine gobbled that up almost before the camera shutter stopped. And why was he allowed to do that? Well, that's because the CIA didn't want, of course, any visual representations of the assassination that would be available to the general public. And even when Jim Garrison in 1968, in his trial against Clay Shaw, when he was able to actually subpoena the film from Time and Henry Luce, well, what did they do? They didn't give him a first-generation copy so that he would have that. They gave him about a fourth-generation copy, which means, and remember, back then it was analog. It was film, but it was analog. So it's not like it is today where you can make a copy of a digital file and it stays 100% accurate. Back then, if you made a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, you're down four generations, and all of the artifacts of that film and all of, and the sharpness goes away. It's like people that remember the VHS days. If you tried to make a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a VHS tape, then you know what I'm talking about. So they even had the ability to insert themselves in Jim Garrison's trial against Clay Shaw. And of course, much worse than that, both the FBI and CIA both had operators who had infiltrated Garrison's case and were actively working to undermine him during his trial. Sticking on the subject, immediately when Garrison's investigation really got hot and became well known, well, what happened? You know, both the CBS and the NBC networks produced really major documentaries undermining Garrison and calling into question not only his investigation but also his ability. Basically, what they were saying was he was a crook and he was lying, and they were just undermining his whole identity. It got so bad that they actually had to give him time on the network in order to refute some of the information that they were putting out against him.
I think it was like a fair play doctrine or something like that, that he proved that they had libeled him and he demanded equal time. Unbelievable,
It really was. It actually was. And, you know, and that's it. So that's really what the, you know, there's all of this other stuff. In Bolivia, the CIA, there was tin mines that were making huge profits. And what happened? The CIA came out with an effort to what they called rationalize the tin mines, which meant calling for the firing a lot of tin miners and resettling them in new jobs. That gave them the ability to control, to make sure that they kept controlling the tin, the profits that came out of Bolivia with the tin. In Brazil, it was the same thing. They had covert action in the labor movement, and that they had extremely large-scale operations in Brazil that we didn't know about before. So it goes on and on, Len, but we're interested in, I think, here really is that if the CIA over those years leading up to 1963, not only were they involved around the world with removing leaders that they didn't like, for mainly for not just political reasons, but for financial reasons, probably mostly financial reasons, then they just got rid of them. And that included murder. That's where the whole Murder Incorporated moniker came. So how are we not to believe? Now, that doesn't even get into Cuba.
I hate to interrupt you, but I just want to mention this for people who don't know. This was Leo Janus interviewing Lyndon Johnson, and he was talking about that, the drug trade, and he said, we're operating a goddamn Murder Incorporated in the Caribbean.
Yes.
And that's where that comes from. And then he asked him, look, can you publicize that or get rid of it? But enough people had heard it. So there's Lyndon Johnson saying, offhand, we're operating a goddamn Murder Incorporated in the Caribbean.
Exactly. And it was just frightening, and it's just sick, and it's just evil. And then, of course, we get to Cuba. And the CIA's, you know, most people know now that they had numerous assassination attempts against Fidel Castro. When they weren't successful, they actually hired the mafia in order to have them try to assassinate Fidel Castro. There were over 10 documented assassination plots or plans that happened. But not only that, but the new documents, and I don't have them in front of me, but the new documents show just how many covert teams they had in Cuba, how many, what they call, they were running about 10 black operations against Cuba per month, about 10 black operations per month. Well, you know, how we get to the assassination of President Kennedy is that we had all of the anti-Castro Cubans in the country that started the most violent with Alpha 66 in Miami, and then the Carlos Perget and the student director, and all of the Cuban anti Castro groups, and we had the paramilitary groups being trained all around the country. In New Orleans, it was around the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, where not only Jack Ruby was providing arms to that group, but where Lee Oswald was also involved in providing training to the paramilitary forces along Lake Pontchartrain. Thomas Arthur Valet, who would have been the patsy in Chicago, was providing training to the anti-Castro paramilitary groups in Levittown, Long Island. And it goes on and on. So we have and when the Kennedys, you know, after the Bay of Pigs, when the Kennedys said, look, this is out of control. We're not going to have these paramilitary groups with the same kind of training and crazy amounts of weapons going to them. Well, what happened? The CIA did not listen. They kept it going. And they were running a shadow government the way they wanted it run. They wanted Castro assassinated. And of course, you know, what happens is that they were basically using the same formula that they were going to assassinate Castro. They turned it around and assassinated President Kennedy. When you look at Chicago, when you look at the four Latin-complected men that were seen, two of them were arrested and investigated all night. They were all anti-Castro Cubans. They had to be because that was the group that was being trained to do assassinations. And then, of course, when that didn't work out and they didn't get in Tampa, then of course it was all hands on deck, and they were going to get him in Dallas, which they did. So the new docs, to me, you know, they give reams of information. It's not, did we expect to get a smoking gun from the new docs? No, of course not. You know, they're not going to release a letter, you know, that spells it out. But we have to look at the cumulative evidence. They're all over the world. They're out of control. Under Eisenhower, there is no oversight of the CIA. They can put money anywhere they want because they're running it through operations in Congress where there is no nobody's going to know about it, and they think they're never going to have to answer for it. So we've got a CIA that's totally out of control. When John F. Kennedy signed NASAM 263, that was, to me, of course, just my opinion, but that was the straw that broke the camel's back. They wanted Cuba, and they wanted that war in Vietnam, and they got it.
Well, I think what you're alluding to, when you do this research, and I'm just going to give you my point of view, that when you talk about a shadow government here, nobody says anything about a shadow mafia. And really, you kind of come to this uncomfortable realization. These guys, with the big banks and money, CIA, it's an agency. You know, who's it working for? Is it working for the Department of Defense, or is it working for Alan Dulles and his Wall Street Sullivan Cromwell friends? And like you say, they're putting every other government out that doesn't bow to their financial needs and drug running. It's uncomfortable. So it's kind of, you throw off the thing, forget about the shadow government. These guys are the guys flexing the muscle. It's like the real Department of Education versus Students' Council in a school or something like that. You think they're doing anything? They're small potatoes. So that's why we've often heard when somebody has to go to testify, says, listen, you'll be gone in 4 or 8 years. We'll be here. So we're not bowing down to you. And then secondly, you know, the agency with Alan Dulles, and when you find out what they were doing in Vietnam was opening up this Golden Triangle, the Nguyen Bank, Castle Bank in the Bahamas, Jamaica, all these drugs and big, big money. That's who was flexing their muscles. Like you said with the mighty Wurlitzer, right? They just, you grow up thinking one thing and then you go, oh, this is the real world. It's completely different. And I've been naive about a lot of things. And I think that's what the CIA documents are slowly revealing, that no, it was not Lee Oswald. It was not a lone gunman. This is what they were doing. And if you stand back and look at the big picture, you go, holy cow, we're up against an iceberg.
And the fact that they controlled the media really made it so difficult for all of us, you know, especially those of us in the JFK research community. You know, I'll bet you everyone feels the same way I did. You know, I can't tell you how many times I had to realize that stuff that I believed when I was a teenager and in my 20s was just BS. It was just lies put out by the CIA. And I had to look at proof that that was the case in order to get past, you know, that lie and move on to the next one. I guess what I'm trying to say here is that the United States populace in the 50s and 60s and 70s, we were literally just being told what the CIA wanted us to know. And the television networks, that's all they were putting out, because they were controlled by these operatives who were actually part of the networks. And it's insidious. It's unbelievable that that was allowed to happen. But it was. And that's, you know, and as we realize the scope of what that Mockingbird program was, we realize that, oh, my God, we've lived in a country that we really didn't know, you know, and that's why it's so important now that we, with some of the documents that are coming out, it's so important that people realize just what happened, and because that's the only way that we're ever going to stop that kind of behavior from happening again.
Yeah, but we've got to understand it first. It's a good thing that some of these documents are being released, just to, like I said, if they had anything that said Lee Oswald actually did it after all these years, they'd be waving it around. Instead, they're embarrassingly trying to cover their tracks. They're still trying to redact some things, although there's approximately 80,000 documents they're saying released. Nothing is saying that it was a lone assassin after all, and it was Lee Oswald. You know, it's encouraging. The sad thing is that you would think Biden or somebody else would have done something good. One of the things Biden did do was he gave cleared
Abraham Bolden.
Right. Biden cleared and he gave an apology to Abraham Bolden.
Yes.
And that was encouraging. But the fact that he still held this, and now we get a divisive guy like Trump. But as much as you hate him, you go, well, he's starting to release documents. He's releasing this. He's going to reopen Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy. And begrudgingly, you got to say, well, I agree with that.
Yep. I totally agree. No matter what you think of him, we're getting some documents now, which is great. And why that, like you said, why that didn't happen under Joe Biden is beyond me. And the only thing I can think of, Len, is that, you know, when you play it out, I think that there was part of the cover-up. I think there were an awful lot of murders that happened as part of that cover-up. And I think that may be part of the actual reason that for so long.
Well, I would disagree with you. And I would say, just as an armchair investigator here, I think it's because the FBI treated Trump so badly with these fake Putin stuff and the P tapes and the Russiagate and all this stuff. He's doing this vindictively. He's just saying, okay, you want to mess with the bull, you get the horns. And now you guys can go into cover-up mode because I'm releasing stuff here. And then all of a sudden, the FBI has to, holy shit, how are we going to cover that? We never dreamed they'd be releasing this shit.
So, yeah. No, I really meant under Biden and some of the earlier presidents. I don't know. Like, I don't know why they wouldn't have released some of this stuff, you know. But, you know, when you've got so many deaths that came after and during the cover up, you know, people like Lieutenant Commander Pitzer, you know, who was retiring. He had taken 16mm autopsy film and he was, you know, he was murdered. They said it was a suicide, which was ridiculous. People like Dorothy Kilgallen, when she was in the middle of her New Orleans investigation, she was killed. Even somebody like Lee Bowers, who is the linchpin of truth, in my opinion, in the whole JFK assassination, nobody's more important than Lee Bowers. He was the guy that was 12 to 14 feet up right above the grassy knoll. He heard the shots. He heard two shots right on top of each other, which he tried to tell the Warren Commission about, which would have proven that it wasn't one shooter, and that shots did come from the grassy knoll. And what happened to him? 3 years later, he was dead, you know? Yeah, it was a car auto accident.
Yeah, single car accident, right?
Yeah, but he thought that he told the people in the ambulance that he thought he got drugged when he stopped at a cafe for lunch. And, you know, there's just so many examples of murders like that. You know, I mean, the people that witnessed the Tippit killing, Benavides, you know, was it his brother that got shot in the head? And
yeah,
killed?
Yeah, because they I think they unscrewed the porch light and they mistook his brother for him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
well, anyway, but you know what? It's rhetorical because your question kind of answers itself, that you think Clinton is going to rat out the big money drug trade. You think Obama is going to do this. So even Biden and even Trump, you know, years ago, he said, hey, we're going to release the files. And then the day before, somebody had a talk with him and he said, no, we're not releasing them. So then he in his first term, everyone knows that. But, you know, that's it. People have been told, and imagine that. Somebody told the president not to do what he said he was going to do yesterday. So that's where your power is.
What a great point that is. What a great point that is. That shows where the power is. Exactly. Oh, my goodness. It's frightening. It really is.
Okay. Well, one thing that you had mentioned, you've been doing, and there may be a new video on the dark-complected man and the umbrella man. Do you think you could spend a little time on that right now? Because that's something that interested a lot of people. You know, it interested me when it looks like the guy's got a walkie-talkie behind him, their actions after the assassination. And then years later, the guy, Louis DeWitt, I believe, and he opens up his umbrella at the House Select Committee on Assassination. He said, this is the umbrella I had, and it's not the umbrella.
Yeah.
So what are you working on, and walk us through this?
Yeah, I'm hoping the video will be out this week, and I know you're always good enough to put links to it, so I really appreciate that. Every time I come on, you're such a good friend, and you always link everything, you know, and it makes it so easy for all of us to refer back to each other's research, so thank you for that. I've always been interested in the dark-complected man and the umbrella man, and so I thought I would do as much research as I could on it in order to be able to hopefully look at it with fresh eyes. And I did notice some things that, you know, that I hope to bring out in the video. You know, and it all comes back to that old expression, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was to convince the world he didn't exist. You know, that was the line from, it's been around forever, but it was in The Usual Suspects, the movie back in the 90s. And nothing could be more truthful, in my opinion, here, because it really fits perfectly those two men who have been in plain sight for nearly 62 years. But really, they vanished from our collective sight and our memory. But because they were captured on film and in still frames, we can go back and we can examine it. What I did, even with fresh eyes, you know, a lot of new things occurred to me that I think are worth at least bringing up. Number one, you know, it starts with we have an assassination of the president of the United States. The authorities said that they were able to determine that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin, and they were able to do that in 24 hours. That's how good they said they were. Well, let me tell you, we've had almost 62 years now, and they're trying to tell me that the dark-complected man has never been identified and that the umbrella man was Louis Witt. Well, I don't think so. It might have been Louis Witt, but let's look at it, okay? Let's look at this. First of all, Louis Witt wasn't identified until 1968 in the House Select Committee. All right, when he comes forward. Wait a minute. That's 15 years. Well, what do we know about Lewis Witt? Lewis Witt grew up in Texas. He grew up, I think I have it here. Yeah, he grew up in Rockwall, Texas. He was born in 1924. He was 39 years old when the assassination took place. He was a businessman. He was living. He was working in Dallas in 1963. He worked at the Rio Grande National Life Insurance Company, just blocks from Dealey Plaza. Okay, so you've got a guy who's been, as far as I can tell, he's lived in Texas his whole life. He's living a couple of blocks from Dealey Plaza. How many people in Texas does he know during his lifetime? He knows hundreds of thousands at least, right? He's got his family. He's got his friends. He's got his fellow employees at Rio Grande, the clients that he serves, the people that he knows from when he sits down in a cafe or a restaurant, people that service his dry cleaning. I mean, my God, just like any of us, the people in the community know us. So how? Someone tell me how in 15 years no one has identified a man that lives in their community. It's absolutely ridiculous to me. And when I realized that, it made me upset, actually, because now there's only two, in my opinion, there's only two possibilities. Number one, that it wasn't Lewis Witt, okay? And then the second possibility is that people did come forth, but the FBI, like they did with Julia Ann Mercer, and like they did with a lot of other people, whenever the evidence didn't fit their needs, they covered it up. Okay, so there's only two possibilities, Len, in my opinion, about that. But the truth is that people, if it was Lewis Witt, people would have had to know that. All right. So let's look at what they did that day. All right. First of all, they come to see the President of the United States motorcade, right? Why would both of them be right at the Stemmons Freeway sign? Both of them come without anybody else. They come as individuals, without family, without friends, without anybody else. Both of them are there as individuals. They both end up in exactly the same spot by the Stemmons Freeway sign, which is right at the head of the grassy knoll where the triangulation of fire is going to take place. All right. Then we look, if you look at the Zapruder film or any of the other films, we see that the dark-complected man is right at the curb, and the umbrella man is standing about 8 feet back behind the sign. Neither of them moves from that position when the limousine is approaching them. Everyone else is moving up to wave and try to get the attention of the president. Those two don't. They stay there. And then what do? Each of them performs weird actions. The umbrella man raises his umbrella. He spins it clockwise, right? A crazy, crazy, crazy action to perform in that case. The dark-complected man, he doesn't have his hand out in front of him towards the limousine where he's trying to wave to President Kennedy or the people in the limousine. What does he do? He puts it straight up, and his finger goes straight up, and he starts kind of pointing it towards the sky and bringing it down and then bringing it up. What kind of action is that? Well, when you look at why they didn't move, in my opinion, because they were pre-positioned in order to be able to have a shooter from the grassy knoll make the shot that I believe was the throat shot. If you look at the spacing between, and this is probably being brought out by other people, I just it just happened to occur to me. I just didn't realize this. So if this is old news, then you know, I apologize. But I didn't realize it. So it kind of shocked me that if you look at the behind the culvert or the one of the places on the grassy knoll there where there was some hiding area, it's just a straight shot between the umbrella man and the dark complected man, and Kennedy just in the three frames before he goes to reach for the for his throat, he's looking right at it. And I believe that's where that's a good chance of where the actual throat wound came from. So what were they doing? What was the umbrella man doing? And what were the dark complected man doing? I think, you know, it was obvious to me that they're spotters for the shooting team. They're spotters for who's ever controlling the shooting team. What were they spotting? They were spotting to see if Kennedy's head, if he had a headshot yet. If he had a headshot, there was, and again, this is just, of course, my opinion, but there wasn't going to be any shots from the grassy knoll. There would not have needed to be. But because they didn't have a headshot yet, you know, it went on. The limousine proceeded for the next two or three seconds before the headshot comes. And the headshot has to come from that direction behind the wooden fence before the limousine proceeds to the point where there's a chance that Mrs. Kennedy, Jacqueline Kennedy, could have been hit. They had to make the shot before then. I think a lot of people realize and have said that in the past, and I totally agree with that. But, you know, you look at these two guys, you know, what did they do after that? What did they do after the assassination? Well, we all know what they did, right? Everybody else who hears shots, all the radio guys, the family's still on the ground and photographers are taking, everybody's running up the hill. There's tens of police officers that have running up the grassy knoll trying to get to the parking lot behind the grassy knoll. The people on the other side who have, or near the Texas School Book Depository, they're trying to see, you know, if they can see anything there. So there's a group that's there. The only people that don't do anything are the dark complected man and the umbrella man. What do? They sit down next to each other right on the curb, right by the Stemmons Freeway sign. Now, people that say that the umbrella man, you know, that no matter what you think about the dark complected man, but the umbrella man, oh, no, you know, he was probably didn't have anything to do with it. I say that's BS. Why? Because if you look at the picture, the dark complected man is on that military grade radio and the umbrella man is sitting right next to him looking at him. So he had, even if he didn't have anything to do with it, he had to know that the guy is sitting there on a military grade radio. So he would have certainly had something to say about it. But then, you know, we have the photo of him on the radio when they finally do leave. The dark complected man goes across the grass, you know, and we see something in his back that's clearly obvious that is something to do with the radio or whatever else he's hiding in there. And the umbrella man goes towards the Texas School Book Depository. All right. So that's really, really important that all that stuff happened. But when you look and you say, my God, they were the people that were closest to the president being shot, and the CIA and the FBI and the Office of Naval Intelligence and other military intelligence and the Dallas police and whoever else is investigating the assassination, they can't figure out who Louis Witt is in 15 years when the guy lives and works in Dallas. That makes no sense. You know, the fact that the dark complected man certainly was, you know, there's certain speculation about who he was, but he was almost certainly one of the anti-Castro Cuban folks that were engaged there. who the shooters were. You know, everybody has their own opinion, but that's the least important thing out of everything in the JFK assassination. Who actually pulled the trigger? Who cares who actually pulled the trigger? The only thing that matters is who put them there to pull the trigger. So I get a little upset with this stuff because I realize that there's no example of more shenanigans in the investigation than the lack of information that came from trying to identify those two guys. And I think that when we look at their actions overall, there is nothing that they did in the time that they were by that sign that made it seem like they were actually there in order to greet the president. The Lewis Witt or whoever the umbrella man was, his story in 1968 was that he was trying to make a point of being upset with John Kennedy's father as he and his relationship to Neville Chamberlain and their relationship with the Nazis in 1930s Germany. Now, that is, I've heard some stupid things in my time, but for people to actually believe that is ridiculous. And one of the reasons, in my opinion, again, that I say that is because if the Umbrella Man, if Lewis Witt or whoever that was really, really was worried about making that point, well, they sure as heck would have stepped up to the curb that 8 feet next to the dark-complected man and waved the umbrella there. Where he was, that Umbrella Man, back behind the sign, 2 feet or so behind the sign, there was no way that Kennedy probably was even going to get a good look at him as he passed. So it's just one more point that gives us the cumulative reasoning that they weren't there for any other reason than to be spotters for shooting teams. And that's what I'm working on, Len. Again, a lot of people out there are probably saying, well, Ted, you know, you finally just realized this? You know, how dumb are you? And probably pretty dumb. But you know, the point is that, you know, I never really looked at it in the detail that I'm trying to look at it now. And when you go back with a lot of this stuff in the Kennedy assassination and you look at it with, you know, with fresh eyes, stuff that you haven't seen for a while, you get all these new intuitions because of other things that you know, that, you know, that you've learned between the last time you saw it and now, you know, and when you think about what Lee Bowers said to Mark Lane in his interview, you know, hearing the two shots from the grassy knoll, and then you put the Dictabel shots, you know, that were redone by the, I guess it was the House Select Committee when they took the Dictabel audio and put it in with the possible tracing of the shots with the limousine. It fits perfectly. It absolutely fits perfectly. So anyway, thanks, Len, for letting me rant on that there for a few minutes, because I just think it's a really important aspect that has been, you know, given short shrift when we look at the totality of the evidence in the case.
I am enjoying every minute. And as you're saying, oh, I may have been naive to that. They're, to this day, they still trot out Gerald Posner, right? There's people that I haven't seen your latest one. I'll watch it right away about you may be a lone nut if you believe this. Or you believe, you know, I mean, it's crazy that you have to go against the propaganda and the propaganda of somebody saying, oh, the Warren Commission got it right. They were right all along. No. And what you're doing is you've looked into the Chicago plot. Are you looking at, I mean, how many people outside the JFK assassination community even know about the Chicago plot? I mean, not one in a million. So it takes someone to say, hey, I've watched Oliver Stone's film. I'm starting to have doubts. I'll look into a few things. And as you look into each thing, it's like a bottomless pit. There is just more and more. And it, like I was saying earlier about, don't call them a shadow government. These guys are the big muscle. and they're working on behalf of money, and it's uncomfortable how much drug money comes into it, you know. You know, when you're talking about the Cuban plots against Castro, even the things they did against the Cuban people, we will not let communism thrive under any condition. We will introduce biological problems. Yeah. They were burning crops. They were introducing poisons. They were doing everything. And that's not what the American people thought they were doing. They'd just been told, oh, you know, communism, it's bad, you know. And, you know, how many people died in Vietnam over, we have to stop the domino theory, you know, because if they go communist, everybody else will go communist. And then, you know, it's like America now clinging to their money. They go, well, what's this BRICS thing doing? Because if all the other countries stop using the American dollar, we're in big trouble. And now we got to go into Iran. But anyway, I don't want to get off topic. I appreciate every instance that you've been looking into. And yeah, whatever you were saying earlier, I wouldn't, you know, call you naive or whatever. It's just like, there is a certain amount that you have to kind of unlearn. And after you've listened to all these shows that CBS did and said, you know, the Warren Commission had it right. I mean, as if they read the 26 volumes the next day, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's why so much I appreciate your insight and all your videos. And as actually, you contributed to one of the very good episodes in 50 Reasons for 50 Years, just on that.
Thank you. Yes. Chicago part. Yeah. Let me just say one other thing about the, while I'm on a rant here. If you
No, you got all the time you want, buddy.
Let me say one other thing about the Warren Commission, you know, because, you know, I've read a lot of the Warren Commission. I hadn't read it all, you know, it's just so long, but I've gotten a chance to read most of it now. And I am just, I don't know what the word is. I'm just so incredulous that they got away with the BS that they got away with. And I think in terms of, you know, look at Lee Bowers when he, first of all, you know, when he did the Mark Lane interview and he says, yeah, the FBI did interview me. And, you know, when I told them that the last two shots couldn't have been from the same gun, they had to be from separate guns. He says, well, the FBI reminded me that I'm not a weapons expert and I had to agree with them. Why would the FBI, who's trying to take a deposition about the assassination of the president, the last thing that you would ever do would be to say something like that to someone who's feeding you probably the most important information about the shots that you've ever heard. They didn't want, they even at that point, a couple of days after the assassination, the FBI was in there trying to stop every single bit of information from witnesses that didn't adhere to that single shooter, three bullet theory. Julia Ann Mercer, who a lot of people know, was stopped in traffic a couple hours before the assassination. She clearly saw Jack Ruby as the driver of a green truck, letting off a few people. She thought it was a rifle case that they got out with and headed up to the top of the knoll. Well, some police officers overheard her saying that later in the day at a restaurant and took her back to be interviewed, she picked out Jack Ruby on the day. This is the day of the assassination. She picked out Jack Ruby as the driver of that truck. She also said there was no writing on the truck. There was no notary in the room. And so what happened was the documentary JFK came out and Oliver Stone actually interviewed her. A lot of people know now that what she said, I forget whether she was shown that, I think she was shown the Ruby photo on Saturday before the next day, before he shot Oswald. She says that she picked him out. Okay. And when the Warren Commission volumes come out. What she realizes, she didn't know, but after Oliver Stone, you know, pointed it out, she realized that the Warren Commission said that she couldn't identify Jack Ruby. They said that she said that there was air conditioning written on the green truck that she saw. There was nothing written on the truck, and she was very adamant about that. They had to say that because that led everybody on a wild goose chase to go after air conditioning companies rather than look in the general green truck area. She said that her signature was forged, and she gave specific examples of how that forgery looked, although it was a pretty good forgery, she said, but as she detailed how the forgery happened. And there was a woman notary that notarized it. She said there was no woman in the room when she gave her her testimony, her deposition. So that's another example. When Lee Bowers was called before the Warren Commission, as soon as he mentioned, you know, the shots, they did not ask him about the proximity of the shots, how quickly they were. They knew that if they asked him about that, then their whole ridiculous theory would be blown apart. He's the best. Witness that you can have, and they don't ask him about how quickly he heard the shots. Absolutely ridiculous. You get to the same thing when I did a video two weeks ago, you know, about the finding the Mauser in the Texas School Book Depository when they did the affidavits. Seymour Weitzman, and I can't remember the other officer's name now, but they all said, yeah, and then we have Roger Craig on film saying, yeah, we all looked at it. It was a Mauser. Seymour Weitzman, who knew weapons very well, pointed at it. We all looked at it. We were 6 or 8 inches from it. Okay, so there it is. Then when all three of those officers go before the Warren Commission, they don't ask them about it. They don't ask them about it. They say, did you ever hear that someone said it was a Mauser? And they ask one question, and then they don't say, did you look at it? Was it a Mauser? Did you sign the affidavit? They don't ask him about it. It's absolutely ridiculous because they knew what the answer would be. They knew that they would have to say, yes, I saw it. I did sign that affidavit. They knew they weren't going to lie and say, I did an affidavit, and now I'm not sure. They knew they weren't going to do that, so they just didn't ask him about it. And this happens all the time. When Arlen Specter goes to interview Daryl Tomlinson in Parkland Hospital, he never asks him, is this the bullet that you found that day? Is this CE-399? He never asks him the question because he knows the answer. He knows that Tomlinson is going to say, no, that's not the bullet. The bullet we found has a long, pointy top. He knows that. There were four people that handled the bullet. There was Tomlinson. There was O.P. Wright. There was the FBI guy. I'm not going to remember their names right now. But none of those four would say that was the bullet that they found that day. None of them. So what does the Warren Commission do? They write a report, and they say the author of that report is an FBI agent. And then, I forget the researcher who did the great work, but they found that CIA agent who the Warren Commission attributed that report to. He did not write it. He never saw the bullet. He had nothing to do with CE-999 or anything at Parkland Hospital. And he says, I don't think I ever even saw that bullet. No, it wasn't me. There's no file that says he ever did it. So the Warren Commission was outright blatantly lying to us, not just lying to us, but they were creating files. They were creating reports and putting other people's names on them that they were just figure that no one would ever check into. They were under Dulles and that group. The Warren Commission was just you can't get any more of a facade, of a sham, than the Warren Commission was. One more example. Where was I going
to
go here?
Hold that thought for a second, because I just wanted to – you're pretty passionate about this, and I think you met Commission Exhibit 399.
Yes.
You just said 999. And, you know, just to underscore this, one of my favorite techniques that they did is they would come to something and say, we're going to go off the record for a minute. They would talk to the person. They would say, okay, this, that, and the other. Then would come back on and they go, okay, well, is there anything else that I haven't already asked you about that you want to bring up? And then the guy would say no, because off the record, they already brought up those things. They didn't get put on the record.
That's exactly what they did with the officer whose name I can't remember, and I feel horrible about it. Not Seymour Weissman and not Roger Craig, but the other officer who filed the affidavit. You look at it, and maybe it was Seymour Weissman. I can't remember. It was one of those, and right at the top, it says, off the record, exactly what you just said, Len. So whatever they were discussing, then they come back, they ask one question, and then that's the end of it. So it just absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And I lost that train of thought. I apologize. I had one more example, but my mind is... getting old here. I forgot it.
I'm just, everything you're saying has got that ring of truth to it. It just underscores the fraud of this commission. Never mind, teaching it in school. When you get a divisive character like Donald Trump saying it's fake news, and then you look into stuff and you go, you know, he's right about this. And when we talk about a backlash against the CIA, the FBI, all these institutions, the Justice Department that you would think would be working on behalf of people, especially, well, I don't have to get into off other topics. I was going to say about, you know, the drug running in MENA, Arkansas, and all that, and the stuff Clinton would have had to know about. And then they're just, you know, kicking him back while they're making money. And yeah, it is a fraud after fraud. And the Warren Commission is an example of obfuscation. Like, you know, if they can't define something, they just leave it out.
My God, that's exactly what they did, you know. And, you know, that doesn't come. Oh, I know. I think I remember now. They were when it comes back to the palm print of when Lee Oswald's supposed palm print on the barrel of the gun, Lieutenant J.C. Day, who examines the rifle. When he takes it back, the Mauser, everybody says it's a Mauser. He takes it back to check it in. From there, miraculously, it becomes the Mannlicher Carcano. Well, he sends the Mannlicher Carcano, and he has some cellophane tape around what he thinks might be a partial print. He sends it to the FBI, the greatest fingerprint examiner in the entire world. Sebastian Latona looks at it, says, no, you cannot. There are no prints to get off this gun. So he sends the gun back to Dallas. Well, at that time, of course, Oswald isn't dead, because Friday, Saturday. Now we're so they're starting to panic, because they know Oswald, sooner or later, he's going to have to tell the truth about being an intelligence agent. So what do they want to do? They think they need to get a palm print. So Ruby kills Oswald in the basement of the Dallas City Jail, even though he had made calls to the FBI and the Dallas police all weekend trying to get out of it, telling them don't move him then because he's going to get shot. But they, you know, nobody listens to it. He's the one that he knows. He's the one that has to shoot him. He does. He shoots him. All right. So the gun is back in Dallas now. And then we have so Oswald's dead, and he's going to be buried the next day on Monday. So Sunday night, in the middle of the night, Paul Moody, I believe was his name. I might be mispronouncing it, but he's the head mortuary guy. He gives this great interview, which is included in the Men Who Killed Kennedy documentaries. And he says, well, in the middle of the night, agents did come. And they asked if they could have the room by themselves. We saw the satchel. We saw all the equipment. After they left, we went in and we saw that Lee Harvey Oswald had ink on both his fingerprints and his palm print. They fingerprinted and palm printed him. Well, the next day, Lieutenant J.C. Day says that he took a palm print originally off of the Monica Gargano, but never sent it to the FBI. The most ridiculous story that you could ever come up with. But that's how desperate they were for a while, because Oswald was still alive when they were coming up with all these dumb plans. So he all of a sudden says, oh, I found a palm print. And originally, when I took the palm print, I put tape on it. And when I pulled it off, it must have taken off not only all of the palm print, but all of the fingerprint powder that I used to take the palm print. And then I sent the gun to the FBI. Well, Sebastian Latona and all the FBI guys, when they examine it, they say, there's no fingerprint powder here. There was no palm print. There was zero on it, okay? So they're stuck. So when the gun comes back, they go to the mortuary, they get the palm print, and then they send the palm print back to the FBI at that point. So ridiculous. They actually get the palm print on the 29th of November, a full 7 days afterwards. Now, the Warren Commission, even the Warren Commission can't justify this. So the few people on the Warren Commission that were, actually maybe trying to do good work and get to things, they sent out a letter, and the letter says very specifically, there's way too much confusion about where this palm print came from, and we can't believe the story that we're hearing out of Lieutenant J.C. Day and the Dallas police. We need to do more on this to figure out exactly what happened. And then, of course, nothing ever happens after that. It was so ridiculous that they had to actually send out a letter. And I'm gonna see if I can find real quick. Let me just open this one little file here and see if I can find who that letter went to. I'm just scrubbing it, and there it is. Here's the actual words that they said. They said, Mr. Rankin advised, because of the circumstances that now exist, there was a serious question in the minds of the commission as to whether or not the palm impression that has been obtained from the Dallas Police Department is a legitimate latent palm impression removed from the rifle barrel, or whether it was obtained from some other source. And for that reason, this matter needs to be resolved. So even the Warren Commission, the people on the Warren Commission that weren't totally bogus, had to call them out on that one. So it just gives you it's just more proof that Lieutenant J.C. Day was so compromised, and they were so worried about Oswald being alive, that because they knew it would all fall apart, it was all going to go the way of hell, because they knew that Oswald would realize, as the patsy, that he's got to tell the truth about being an agent. He's got to tell the truth about his involvement in actually trying to infiltrate some of these anti-Castro Cuban groups, especially on Harlandale Street in Dallas, where he had been going and meeting with some of these anti-Castro groups. So it's such a wide, wide net. It's such a massive cover-up that when people say, and I know this, Len, but it makes me so upset when people say, oh, how could a cover-up like this ever have gotten through? You know, two people can't keep a secret. Well, it's the reason it was able to flourish was because they had so many people involved with it. They had the head of James Rowley of the Secret Service. They had a compromised Hoover, who couldn't do anything if he wanted to because of all the dirt they had on him. They had Alan Dulles sitting on the Warren Commission as the de facto head of the Warren Commission. There were people who were disappearing and were actually getting shot and killed. And it happened again in 1966 and 67 when Garrison opened his investigation. You know, 5 days after Garrison's investigation, David Ferry and Eladio Del Valle are both killed within hours of each other. These people were serious about the cover-up, and everybody knew that. And, you know, so this whole idea of you couldn't have a cover-up that big. We've had a cover-up of that big. When you have 3,000 agents, or 3,000 people, excuse me, that are on the payroll of the CIA, in media, in every newspaper, in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in CBS, in NBC, in ABC, then of course you can keep the secret because you're controlling the message. And that's really what it comes down to. Sorry about my little rant there.
No, because that just reminds me of the continual cover-up of, they had George Joannides brought out for the House Select Committee in assassinations, right? So they brought up that, right? And then, to top that off of, they have a continual growing, like watering weeds, the sixth floor museum, where they hire Gary Mack to completely flip sides and take the money and become a prostitute, and they'd put headphones on people, and you walk through there, you look at the pictures, and they say, "Here's how Lee Oswald did it."
Yeah, and anybody that goes up into the sixth floor, if you look out the left window at Houston Street, you realize that limousine is coming at you where you couldn't miss if you tried. If you were trying not to shoot the president, you'd fail, because that's how easy a shot it was, rather than have that limousine make that left on Elm Street and then go behind the trees and down towards the grassy knoll.
Well, it made, point was made that it, on that view, all you had to do really is shoot the driver. And then the car had nowhere to go, and then you shoot everybody in there, you know.
You could have taken the 3 seconds between shots, and you could have killed people in four limousines. I mean, it was so perfectly set up. So, you know, it just makes no sense at all. No sense at all. But, you know, we need to get to this, you know, because I don't know if we're ever going to have another, you know, for whatever reason, Trump, you know, release the docs. I don't really care. You know, this is, you know, one of the chances that we get, not just with the docs, but to really bring the whole subject of the assassination up in order to get people to understand just what they've been living through over the last 4 or 5 decades. You know, and it's really important, because people who begin to understand that they can't believe what they're being told by the media, you know, in general, all the time. You know, even if we just get to that point, you know, at least some good has come out of it, you know. So
no, and actually it's concerned citizens such as yourself that have made that effort, right? Every government agency has dragged their heels or fighting, you know, tooth and nail to hang on to documents. They're not saying, look, we know, we looked into it, and here are the documents that prove Lee Oswald did it. Here's the documents that prove it was James Earl Ray. Here's the documents that prove it was Saran. And you want to keep going on and on? You know, what about Michael Hastings? You know, the reporter that was doing the expose on the Pentagon and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and that, you know. His car blows up. I mean, and how many others, right?
Yeah. Oh, you know, and you know what else is funny? And just this just made, I didn't realize this before. I just, you know, again, just happened to click in my mind. But the when you look at what the Dallas press and the Dallas police were putting out in the media on the weekend after the assassination. Again, let me just wanted to get this straight. Let me see if I can find this file here. I don't know if I can find this. I don't know if I can find it. But anyway, there were District Attorney Henry Wade put out a this was in the LA Times, and they picked it up from the Dallas paper. I forget what the Dallas paper was called. And what he said was, this is without any attribution. This is without any evidence. This is without anything. So they're just saying that they have a source that says that Lee Oswald got on the bus after the assassination and a man asked him about if the president was shot. And he said, yeah, the president was shot. And a lady asked him, did you say the president was shot? He said, yeah, the president was shot. And then he laughed wildly. That was the thing. He laughed wildly. Then they also said that they found a map with the each intersection marked off in Dealey Plaza, and then a line of a trajectory line from the Texas School Book Depository to where the limousine would be in Dealey Plaza. They were telling this to the media on Saturday. This was actually reported on Monday in the LA Times, because it was like the wrap up from the weekend. So you can see how desperate they were. They're trying to put out this worldview of Lee Oswald, and man, they realized that, oh my God, he's still alive. He should have been dead, you know, yesterday on Friday during the assassination. Somehow this guy stayed alive. We got to come up with all this crazy stuff, you know, just to hurry up and put it in people's mind. Now, you know, from somebody that's taught journalism for the last 20 years at the university level, I can tell you that you would never print something like that without attribution. You have to have attribution for everything, but especially a claim like that. So what they're trying to do is put it out and not attribute it to anybody. And again, it just goes to the desperation of this group that of what they were all going through on Saturday until Sunday morning, when Jack Ruby was able to, you know, be let into the basement to be able to shoot Oswald, because this thing was all going to go south on him in a hurry. And, you know, that just happened to come to my recollection. And I just thought people would find that kind of funny, you know. And I have that in one of the videos, and I have the LA Times report. And so they can see just the nonsense that was coming out of Dallas at that time during that weekend. So,
well, you know, as it being a tried and true, it just reminds me of them finding the passport of one of the hijackers, you know, 9/11. Oh, we found his passport right down here after the fireball and so much fire, the whole building fell down. But, oh, they found it. We know, Bin Laden.
It's crazy stuff. You know, it really is. Wow.
Next thing you'll be telling me is that Anderson Cooper works for the CIA.
Oh, gosh. You know, who knows? You know, I wouldn't believe anything or disbelieve anything at this point. And, you know,
I'm saying that with a smile. You know that he took the training.
Oh, did he know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah.
Goodness. Oh.
So, you know, their view is America right or wrong. And I'm on this side, and I will keep reporting that. But luckily, through COVID and many things about Trump, that people are sticking to alternative media for information, you know, such as Joe Rogan or I don't know, Jimmy Dore, Russell Brand, so many people, and then you get to hear John Mersheimer and Mike Benz and so many. You get the real truth, and even talking to you, I could tell from somebody for like an hour and a half. You get, oh, okay, this guy has done the research. He knows what he's talking about. I can agree or disagree. Maybe I'm going to have to look into what does he say. How can that be true? You know,
right.
And that's, you know, probably the popularity of Black Op Radio too. You know, you get to hear people and agree or disagree, but this is what you found, and that's what's good about your videos that I enjoy, and probably the reason that I did 50 reasons for 50 years, the same thing, you know, like, here are the facts of the case, and they do not add up to the conclusion that the Warren Commission is, and like we said about Gary Mack and John McAdams and those guys and the Posners, I mean, they're waving this insanity around as if they just keep saying it, if we can get enough people to believe it, it'll be true.
I just can't figure out why they keep doing it. I mean, I literally can't figure it out. That's why I did that video. You may be a lone nutter because there's too much fact. There's too many obvious facts, provable facts that people like that. They, in my opinion, they have to have some secondary reason, some alternative reason, while they're still trying to peddle that baloney. And I don't know what it is,
found out from USAID revelations that how many funding grants and money is just handed out without any kind of paper trail, unnamed accounts, writing checks to, you know, phony company after another, you can't trace it after that. So it's just, yeah, they want to make sure that this mighty Wurlitzer is funded, and they're taking money from whoever knows whatever drug money bank account that Alan Dulles and the CIA never had to worry about a thing. They already, Ed Lansdale told Prouty, he said, I had a blank check, you know, and if you look into this Philippines gold that was discovered and all these other things, and then, you know, when Cat Airlines and the Vietnam War and the drug smuggling and all that, they had so much money they had to invent their own banks to hide the money. So now when they want to do an overthrow of a government, they got to buy 10,000 rifles or something like that. They've got the money for that. They buy their own airplanes. They play, you know, Air America and all that stuff. It's just kind of, you know, over coffee, people know, oh yeah, that was CIA, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there you go. And that's what your video revealing was. It was China just giving another punch that, look, it's the CIA. For sure it is. And every time, and even 6 months from now, if there's more documents, they are going to just say, yeah, there was a lot of crooked stuff going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably, I've always thought that's how it's going to get resolved, is they're going to say, yeah, a lot of crooked stuff. And it was just a few bad apples. They're going to stick with that, you know, and they'll probably throw out Hunt and a few other people, try to, you know, throw them to the wolves and hope people that will stop there. But, at this point, I don't think that's going to work for them. I think too much has already been revealed that I think the CIA is just going to be recognized as the, you know, as just a group led by a very evil few men that were out of control. And unfortunately, a lot of that stuff still happens today. And, we've got to deal with it as a democracy. You know, we've got to enable laws. We've got to create laws. We've got to elect people that, you know, come up with ways. And we've got to, I don't know, just, of course, just my opinion, but we have to have a democracy 2.0 in this country where, you know, where we do have oversight and we don't treasure secrecy the way that we have over the past 60 years. Instead, we really treasure openness and, and holding people's feet to the fire and really holding them to a higher level of performance if they want to be elected, you know. And I think that, you know, I still have a problem with term limits. I don't think people should serve for decades and decades and decades this is, again, this is off the topic, but I just think that, you know, sometimes that's how some of this stuff starts. When you have kind of a clean sweep of electors.
Yeah.
Congressman,
just to butt in there, the amount of money around it, when you hear about how much Nancy Pelosi was worth before and now. But anyway, the amount of money that people going into politics have to start with, and then when they're retiring, it's just astronomical, you know, worth $1 million and now worth, you know, $2.6 billion. You know, how do you...
Even look at you know, at our current vice president, you know, I mean, he was basically bankrolled by Peter Thiel, right? To almost where one person, one billionaire at this point can basically get somebody elected as a senator or a congressman. I mean, Citizens United has to be overturned at some point. We can't allow money in our elections to just keep running rampant. I think there should be extreme limits to what anyone outside of a state can contribute to someone running in that state. You know, someone in the state, they, you know, whatever, that might be something different. But, you know, how can we keep letting individuals that have nothing to do with the state be able to control that state's politics by donating dark money of however many hundreds of millions, or, you know, millions or even $100 million. It's crazy. You know, what kind of a democracy are we living in when we have a country where elections aren't honest? They're just bought at this point. It's just absolutely, it's embarrassing. It's absolutely.
When you say term limits, I mean, there's somebody like Lindsey Graham that I just can't believe. I mean, to me, he's crazy. He's absolutely crazy. War with everyone. War. And Oh, you know what we want to do in Ukraine? They've got trillions of minerals. We want those minerals. I mean, what the hell?
It's just so selfish. It's just so ridiculous. I mean, how you get to be that way? How you? I mean, God, don't you have any? Don't these people have any morals? Don't they have any? I mean, don't they really believe in God? I'm. Being a Catholic, you know, after 12 years of Catholic school, you know, I it kind of comes back to that to me. But, you know, it's embarrassing to me that we live in a country where our politics are all driven by money and people have no personal responsibility anymore. You know, it's sad. The only good thing about it is that it's so bad. Sometimes, you know, when things get so bad, that's when change happens. And that's the only thing that I hold out hope for, is that things are getting so bad that, you know, maybe somebody a lot smarter than myself will come up with, you know, some way that we can start changing how politics and democracy works in this country. Hopefully somebody will do that, and maybe we'll get lucky. I still have the belief that good always overcomes evil. Sometimes you have to wait around a long time for it to happen, in my opinion, but hopefully that might be the case.
Okay. Well, you're a good catalyst for this. So thanks for the good work that you do. And if you're saying people look at your work, you may get inspired and go further with it. So we're helping to explain what really happened. And I think that's why people are interested in the assassination. And then if you can propose something that to stop it from happening again, let's just understand the scope of the problem to start with.
Exactly. Well done. And let me just say before I go today that, again, I'm not saying this because I'm talking to you now, but Black Hawk Radio has been my go-to resource for, you know, the last 15 years or so. And nobody does a better job of keeping the assassination at the forefront of thought and having the people on week after week after week that really are the people that we need to be listening to. So thank you so much for having Black Hawk Radio. I know how much of an effort it is for you to have done that for so long. It's just my favorite, and I just wanted to throw that out there. I know so many people in the JFK community feel exactly the same way, and I know you're not one that takes compliments very well, but you're going to have to take it this time because you have just done tremendous and wonderful and needed work. So thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thanks for the kind words. All right then, Mr. Tidyakuchi, keep up your good work. We'll make links to your channel and to your recent videos, and I urge everybody to watch them. They're worth it.
Thank you, Len.
All right.
Nice being with you.
All right, good night.